The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats.com and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Yasmina Boutaleb, a White House reporter here at the Post. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland and a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Van Hollen, welcome to Washington Post Live.
Yasmin, great to be with you.
Well, we have a lot to cover today, so I'll dive right in on the news of the day because I believe you're going to leave this and then go vote. So over the weekend, the House passed a national security package that provides funding for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, as well as humanitarian aid for Gaza and elsewhere. The House also passed a fourth bill that seizes Russian assets and would ban TikTok if it isn't sold by its Chinese parent. While the House passed the four parts separately, the bills are combined into one in the Senate. Right after this interview, I believe you will join your colleagues in the Senate to vote to move on the measure. Do you expect the bill to ultimately pass, and do you yourself have any reservations about voting for it?
Well, Yasmin, as you said, we will be voting on a motion to proceed with this bill that came from the House. And as you said, in the United States Senate, all the components will be merged into one. So this will include the $60 billion in military assistance to the people of Ukraine, along with the other elements you mentioned. So in my view, the need to get the people of Ukraine military assistance is an absolute priority. I've said that all along. I said that when this supplemental bill was in the United States Senate. And if we were not to do that, it would undermine U.S. leadership around the world. Now, as to reservations, I do have reservations because I've also said that while I strongly support sending Israel defensive weapon systems, Iron Dome and other essential systems for their defense, that when it comes to offensive weapon systems, we should not be providing a blank check. We should be using our leverage effectively to achieve President Biden's stated goals of making sure we get more humanitarian aid into Gaza, making sure there's no invasion of Rafah. And so I have reservations about this bill because those requirements are not embedded in it. I will say, I just a few minutes ago filed amendments to the bill, one very much along the lines that I just mentioned with respect to offensive weapons to the Netanyahu government, and also one that would restore U.S. support for UNRWA.
So I actually want to jump to an audience question that we have just because it touched so much on a big part of your answer. So this is from Joseph Gentile from Maryland, who wants to know, is it possible to put restrictions on U.S. aid such that it is only used for defensive purposes rather than for continuing aggressive military operations in Gaza?
Well, is it possible? Yes. And in fact, you know, the amendment that I've proposed would essentially say that we cannot transfer additional offensive weapon systems to the Netanyahu government unless they've taken certain actions with respect to Gaza. Again, making sure we allow humanitarian assistance into Gaza, making sure there's no invasion of Rafah, making sure we have an independent investigation into the killings of humanitarian aid workers. I have filed that amendment, but I will just say in complete transparency, it's going to be very difficult to be able to get a vote on that amendment. So you asked me earlier on whether I had reservations. The short answer is I do, which is why I filed these amendments. But just backing up again, I do think it's absolutely essential that the United States fulfill its commitments and promises to the people of Ukraine at this moment when they're under attack by Putin.
Senator, you and I have discussed this, but I want to ask you in light of just the last couple of weeks and more information that's come out. The Leahy laws refer to legislation named after then-Senator Patrick Leahy that prohibits providing military assistance to individuals or security force units that commit gross violations of human rights with impunity. Do you believe the U.S. is running afoul of this law right now?
Well, we may get the answer to that question very soon, because there are reports that Secretary Blinken is right now considering a recommendation from within the State Department to apply Leahy law sanctions to a particular unit of the IDF where they've identified that they committed gross violations of human rights, including the death, the wrongful death of a Palestinian American. And so the question will be whether Secretary Blinken moves forward with that recommendation. He has said that the United States needs to apply its laws and standards equally wherever the U.S. is providing military assistance. I agree that needs to be the case. And I do think that the information put forward clearly justifies putting this unit on that list of Leahy law violations. So we will see. We're already seeing, the Prime Minister Netanyahu and others pushing back on these reports, which in my view makes it all the more important that the Secretary of State apply U.S. law and standards in a consistent and firm manner.
Another issue I think that you've been very outspoken about is the impending Rafah invasion. This has obviously been a point of contention between the Biden administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu for a couple months now, that the Israeli government has said they will still go into Rafah, where there's about 1.5 million Palestinians sheltering there who fled south under Israeli orders. And the Biden administration has opposed such an operation until there is a credible plan to protect the Palestinians there. We know that they've hosted a number of high-level meetings to discuss this. So you visited Rafah in January. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you saw and whether you believe Israel will go through with their military invasion of Rafah and disregard the advice of President Biden and many others who have urged against such a large-scale operation, and just tell us what that would mean for the Palestinians who are there.
Well, as you indicated, you've got about 1.2 million Palestinians who fled from other parts of Gaza to Rafah because they were told that was the safe place to go. And you now have a population of close to 1.5 million Palestinians in Rafah. And I see no way, at least based on the way this war has been conducted to date, that you could have an invasion in Rafah that did not include massive levels of civilian casualties and even more human suffering that we see right now, which is why President Biden has said that there should not be an invasion of Rafah. What I've been focused on is trying to make sure that President Biden's words are heeded, because we have seen a pattern over many months where President Biden has sort of beseeched the Netanyahu government to take certain actions with respect to humanitarian aid. As President Biden said, stop the indiscriminate bombing. Those are his words. But those have been mostly ignored. So this is why, getting back to your earlier question about U.S. military assistance, I have called on the administration to pause U.S. military assistance. We're talking today about the appropriations, but that's the beginning of the process. The end of the process are the actual transfers of weapons. And what I've said to the administration is, until the president's objectives are secured, we need to use all the tools in our toolbox to make sure we're effective. And that's why I think the White House needs to be very clear that because an invasion of Rafah would cause so much additional human suffering, that the president needs to make sure that his will is enforced.
There is, of course, both in Rafah but across Gaza, just a devastating humanitarian situation taking place. There have been reports that famine is underway in parts of Gaza, particularly in the north, and that everyone in Gaza, about 2.2 million residents, face severe malnutrition or acute food shortages. So given all of that, do you believe the U.S. should restore funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency based on a report that came out this week that concluded that Israel has not provided evidence that significant numbers of workers with that agency are tied to militant groups.
I do believe the United States should restore funding to UNRWA. It's very important that the UN continue its other investigation, which remains ongoing, into whether or not up to 14 members of UNRWA participated in the horrific October 7th attacks on Israel. And if they did, they need to be held entirely accountable and punished accordingly. But UNRWA in Gaza is an organization of over 13,000 people that, as this most recent report indicated, have an essential role in providing humanitarian assistance to people who are on the verge of starvation, some who have starved to death in Gaza. And so, yes, the United States, in my view, should not have withheld so quickly all the assistance. But this report clearly indicates that the claims that have been made by Prime Minister Netanyahu and others that somehow UNRWA is a proxy or a front group for Hamas are just baseless. I mean, that is just a lie, as I've said before. So the United States should restore that funding because they're an essential organization for distributing humanitarian assistance in Gaza. And when I was in Rafah, as you mentioned, it was back in January, there are lots of things that need to change right now to make sure starving people get assistance. Making sure that UNRWA remains functional is one of them, but there are other things that need to be done right away to avoid things like the deaths of the World Central Kitchen workers, as well as 200 other aid workers who've been killed.
Well, I want to shift to President Biden's approach over the last several months. So just building on the last part of your answer, we know that a couple weeks ago, President Biden held a call with Netanyahu where he called the situation in Gaza unacceptable and seemed to threaten to condition support to Israel if Netanyahu and the Israeli government did not make immediate concrete changes in Gaza, including allowing in much more humanitarian aid, doing a better job of protecting aid workers and protecting civilians more broadly. In the last couple of weeks, do you think there's been evidence that Israel has significantly ramped up the delivery of aid into Gaza or taken measures to alleviate the situation on the ground?
I think there's been some marginal improvement in what I call the inputs. In other words, more crossings open. The Eretz crossing has been open. There are reports that a lot more trucks are getting through, which in many ways reinforces the point that many of us have made, which was this is a decision the Netanyahu government could have made much earlier. But I'm also told that even now, for example, UNRWA is not allowed to deliver humanitarian assistance into northern Gaza, where starvation is particularly acute. We also need to resolve these so-called deconfliction issues. The fact that we saw the deaths of the World Central Kitchen workers, and as I said earlier, they were among 200 aid workers that have been killed. Until that is clearly resolved and people can safely deliver assistance into places like northern Gaza, we still have a big problem. So I would say some marginal progress, but the way to measure progress at the end of the day is to see whether people are still dying of starvation, to see whether kids have medicine and other people have medicine. Right now, there are lots of stories of amputations without anesthesia. So that should be the true test of whether a system is really working. And look, I want to emphasize the point that in the aftermath of the horrific attacks of October 7th, everybody understood and understands to this day that Israel has a right to defend itself. And I would say duty to do so, but that right does not include the right to arbitrarily restrict access to humanitarian aid for people in desperate need, nor does it justify some of the you know, what President Biden referred to as indiscriminate bombing. So I think it's really important at this moment that the president follow through on that statement to Prime Minister Netanyahu that you just referenced, which is that if we do not see significant improvements in the areas the president has outlined, then the president has to be willing to use all the tools at his disposal to make sure that his objectives are satisfied.
We've spoken a lot about this, and there's been a lot written and discussed about President Biden's bear hug approach to Israel in the wake of the October 7th attacks. He, of course, flew to Tel Aviv just days after the attacks, demonstrated firm U.S. support of Israel in the wake of the attacks and the killings. And part of the strategy was that if you held Israel close and refrained from criticizing them in public, you could influence them in private and influence their actions. The administration would, of course, argue that they have done this because Israel didn't want to allow any aid in, and they have allowed, you know, very limited amounts of aid in, and some other measures related to the military strategy, reducing the number of troops, not attacking Hezbollah. But now we seem to be at a point where President Biden is often left holding the bag. Netanyahu very publicly defies the president's requests and urgings despite unprecedented U.S. support throughout this war. The U.S. looks unable to significantly influence Israeli actions, especially in recent months. So in terms of this bear hug strategy, do you view that as that was the right move or part of a miscalculation on the part of the president and his administration? And how would you characterize their approach to the war right now? They have, of course, ramped up criticism, but haven't fundamentally changed unconditional U.S. support to Israel.
Well, Yasmin, I supported the idea of the bear hug, right? I thought it was right for President Biden to go to Israel in the aftermath of the horrific October 7th attacks and to say to the Israeli people, the United States is with you. It's what's followed that, where I don't think that the Biden administration has most effectively used the leverage that it has, because we have had this pattern where for months and months after the bear hug, you had President Biden requesting, demanding that certain actions being taken, only to be mostly ignored by Netanyahu, and often in very public ways. And I'm not just talking about the fact that humanitarian assistance did not flow the way it should have flowed, or exactly the way, you know, the war in Gaza was conducted. I'm also thinking about things like, you know, the president trying to create some light at the end of this very dark tunnel by talking about the need to somehow have a two-state solution going forward, only to be very publicly rebuffed by Prime Minister Netanyahu. And even today on the ground in the West Bank, every day we see more and more extremist settler violence. Just the other day, we saw Smotrich, one of the ministers in the Netanyahu government, essentially take steps to legalize all these illegal outposts. We've seen over the many last months additional land grabs of Palestinian land in the West Bank. So for all these reasons, I do believe the Biden administration needs to be more effective in using our leverage. I do want to say I applaud them for the actions they've taken with respect to some of the sanctions they've placed on settlers in the West Bank, and they just opened the door a little wider recently on that. I applaud them if they're going to move forward finally on the Leahy law piece. But while we're doing this, there is this ongoing land grab on the West Bank. So I do think the Biden administration really needs, again, to use all the tools at its disposal going forward.
I want to bring in another audience question. This one is from Peter Meyer from Virginia, who asks, what can President Biden do to address dissatisfaction with U.S. policy toward Israel since October 7th?
Well, I think that the president, you know, clearly has moved somewhat since his early days of sort of unqualified support for steps taken by the Netanyahu government. What he needs to do, Yasmin, is convert that statement that he made in his most recent phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu before the Iranian situation arose, where he said that we're going to be monitoring compliance with the president's objectives. And if we don't see progress, the president will talk about a change in policy. I think that that's going to have to be the test ultimately. I will also point out that one of the things I worked very hard on when the supplemental was first in the United States Senate was, together with 18 of my colleagues, I introduced an amendment that said that U.S. military assistance to any country, whether it's Israel, Ukraine, no matter what country, it has to be very clear that those countries are complying with international law with respect to use of U.S. weapons, and that they are allowing the delivery of humanitarian assistance. That needs to be applied in this circumstance. On May 8th, there's a very important report that the administration must make to Congress on whether or not countries, Israel, Ukraine, and others, to the extent to which they're complying with those requirements. It will, in my view, be a test of the credibility of the administration and whether it applies these standards equally.
The administration's primary goal through this whole war has, of course, been to avoid broader regional escalation. Recently, we saw more direct confrontation and escalation between Iran and Israel, these tit-for-tat strikes that went back and forth that started with an Israeli strike in Damascus, Syria, that killed an Iranian general and several others. And then, of course, Iran fired more than 300 missiles and drones into Israel, and Israel fired back at a remote base in Iran. There is cautious optimism that this is maybe not going to escalate any further, at least right now. But we have entered this new phase where Iran and Israel have shown a willingness to strike inside each other's countries directly. And so I'm curious how you view that recent escalation and the risk of a wider regional conflict, and what steps need to be taken right now to head that off.
Well, I do want to give the Biden administration a lot of credit for using their influence to prevent an escalation in this particular instance from spiraling out of control. As you said, you had this strike that Israel conducted against the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, Syria. And the Iranians responded by firing over 300 missiles, combination of missiles at Israel. The United States, together with some of our partners in the region, and of course Israel itself, were successful at intercepting virtually all of those incoming missiles. A few got through. And there was a risk that Israel would respond in a massive way that would just lead to more escalation. And so I do think that the Biden administration was successful in making clear to the Netanyahu government that that would be a huge mistake. But going forward, the only way to make sure that we don't have continued escalation is to get a ceasefire and a return of all the hostages. We just need a ceasefire and a return of all the hostages. I'm glad that our CIA director, Bill Burns, has been at the table. We're gonna need to redouble that effort. And in the longer term, Yasmin, it's gonna be really important that President Biden follow through on his goal of achieving a two-state solution, both for the security of the people of Israel and for the dignity of the Palestinian people. And that would come in the form of a broader agreement in the region that would include normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, a very big deal that would be, as well as other Arab states that have yet to recognize Israel. But it will also have to include a meaningful a step and very clear end goal, end time too, for the creation of a Palestinian state. And of course, the creation of Palestinian state is getting more and more difficult by the day because of the expansion of settlements and outposts. So we are at a critical moment for those of us who still hold on to some hope of a two-state solution and a broader peace in the region. I do believe this is really our last chance in the coming months.
Well, Senator, we have about a minute left, so I want to ask just a little bit of a personal question to end. Some people might not know your background, but you grew up in Pakistan. Your father was in the Foreign Service, and your mother was a renowned intelligence analyst at the State Department who also worked at the CIA. So we'd love to know, how does that upbringing and experience inform your approach to foreign policy today as a key member of the Senate?
Well, thank you for raising that. There was, I think, on Jeopardy once, a question about naming the one member of Congress who had been born in Pakistan. I don't think they got it right. But look, I grew up in a Foreign Service family. I was proud that we represented the United States overseas. You know, my father was originally from Baltimore City, went into the Navy, and then he went to serve in the Foreign Service. And my mom, as you said, she had been the daughter of an English teacher who became a Russian language expert. And so they were really, really partners. And so I'm a big believer in American leadership around the world, and not just military leadership, but the power of our example. And if we're going to be true to our example, then when it comes to things like human rights and democracy and freedom and dignity, we need to be consistent. We need to apply that not just to our adversaries, but also to our friends and partners, because otherwise people around the world will see that our call for human rights and a values-based foreign policy is simply a convenient political tool with which we go after our adversaries, but don't apply to our friends. And this is why I am very invested in the idea that we have to be true to our values and apply them equally and in a fair way if others are going to take us seriously. And President Biden has put a lot of stock in having a values-based foreign policy, especially after his predecessor's approach, which is why it is even more important that under the Biden administration that we're true to these values. And that is why I proposed the amendment that led to NSM 20, which says that when we provide military assistance, we have to ensure that it's used in a manner consistent with international law, and that countries that receive it will cooperate in providing humanitarian assistance to people in desperate need. But you're right, growing up in a Foreign Service family certainly helped instill some of those values.
Well, Senator, I would love to continue, but we unfortunately have to let you go vote. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was a fascinating conversation.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
The new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.